words, chairing a recent House subcommittee hearing, deserve special condemnation. Near the hearing's end, Self recognized the committee's newest, most junior member, Delaware Democratic Congressmember Sarah McBride, the first transgender person elected to Congress. Self purposefully misgendered her. He said, "I now recognize the representative from Delaware, Mr. McBride." To which McBride replied, "Thank you, Madam Chair." Misgendering him without missing a beat. Self was immediately challenged by Massachusetts Democrat Bill Keating. He said, "Mr. Chairman, could you repeat your introduction again, please?" Self said, "Yes. We have set the standard on the floor of the House, and I'm simply," Keating said, "what's that standard, Mr. Chairman? Would you repeat what you just said when you introduced a duly elected representative from the United States of America, please?" Self said, "I will. The representative from Delaware, Mr. McBride." Keating says, "Mr. Chairman, you are out of order. Mr. Chairman, have you no decency?" Keating added, "You will not continue with me unless you introduce a duly elected representative the right way." Self quickly adjourned the hearing. He attempted to demean McBride. His attempt to demean her was the latest abuse heaped on her since her November election win, flowing from Trump's constant incitement of anti-trans hatred to rally his MAGA base. Since Trump's inauguration, he's issued at least 8 executive orders and memoranda targeting trans people. Back in July 2023, we spoke to congressional candidate Sarah McBride, who anticipated the hostility if she were elected. She said, "Let the pettiness of these far-right wing politicians contrast with our focus on progress. Let their cruelty contrast with our compassion. Let the diversity of our humanity be more fully seen in the halls of Congress and to help reinforce that trans people are part of the rich fabric of America, that we have something to offer, that we are talented, thoughtful, effective legislators," she said. Laws targeting transgender people are being debated in state houses nationwide. The latest data from Trans Legislation Tracker cites 738 bills, I think it's higher now, in 2025 pipeline. The number of such bills being introduced shot up exponentially in recent years. McBride explained the surge. She said, "Ultimately, these laws that seek to restrict access to medically necessary health care for transgender people are all part of a cruel and concerted agenda that's meant to distract from the fact Republicans have absolutely no policy agenda to address the needs of workers and families in this country. This is part of an ongoing strategy that the far right wing has attempted to utilize throughout generations, which is to seek to divide and conquer. Trans people are just their new target." There have been a number of lawsuits. Several have been successfully blocked. While the court battles proceed, the lives of transgender people are still at risk. Now is the time for organizing an unflinching solidarity so that facing rising authoritarianism, we don't end up, paraphrasing the anti-Nazi German theologian Pastor Niemöller, we don't end up paraphrasing him and saying, "First they came for trans Americans, but I said nothing. Then they came for me." And the place to hear the voices of people talking about their sexuality, talking about their politics, talking about their concerns way beyond their gender identity. Because they're being reduced to only talking about that. It's in media. It's in that huge table that we all sit around. I wanted to end with just two quick stories. I know I have like 5 minutes. One is back in 2016, being at Standing Rock in North Dakota, because it was the largest gathering of indigenous people this country had seen in decades. It was the Standing Rock Sioux taking on the Dakota Access Pipeline, afraid that when it went under the Missouri River, the longest river in North America, it could pollute the all of the people, native and non-native, living downstream to the tune of tens of millions of people, and that it was a danger to everyone. You know, it was April 1st, 2016. That was an election year when Clinton ran against Trump. You know, in that year, Environmental issues in the presidential debates were hardly raised, let alone DAPL, the Dakota Access Pipeline, yet this historic gathering was happening. It started with the unofficial historian of the Standing Rock Sioux, LaDonna Brave Bull Allard, who would later die of cancer. But she said, you know, we have to take on this. We can't do it alone. Anyone who wants to come to help us fight the standoff at Standing Rock, I'll open my property and you can set up your teepees or your tents, whatever. And she thought a couple dozen people would come. She had enough food for them. Dozens came, then hundreds came, then thousands of people came. They set up one resistance camp after another. Democracy Now! Was out there at Labor Day weekend of 2016. We came late to it. We were reporting on it from New York, but then we got there. It was Labor Day weekend, an official federal holiday, and we saw a group of people moving to a property that they said was their sacred burial ground. It was a holiday. They were shocked that they were seeing bulldozers excavating this property that was being debated in court later that week. A judge was going to rule on whether the Dakota Access Pipeline could do this, the company. And so they ran to the site. There were the bulldozers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. We were running after them. We had our microphone and camera to record what was happening. It was kids. It was older women. It was older men. It was boys. They came up on the site, and they stood in front of these bulldozers. This is earth-crushing, major bulldozers. Their lives were clearly threatened by this, but the bulldozer operators didn't want to threaten their lives, so they started moving back, one bulldozer after another, and the people went forward, and amazingly enough, with hundreds of people, the bulldozers were pushed back. That meant the security of Dakota Access Pipeline came out with dogs to stop the retreat. They came out with dogs, and we just kept filming. They were biting the indigenous people, the allies. We filmed a dog with his nose and mouth covered in blood. They were denying that they were macing people, which they were. People were coughing, people were running, but people were moving forward. And eventually, even the security guards pulled their dogs away. The tractor drivers, they all pulled away. So we had this incredible footage, and we posted it online. You know, when I go into the networks, MSNBC, CNN, when I've been invited in, I say, why don't you deal more with the climate issue? And they say, we want to, the host would say. But our executives say, you know, people's eyes would roll. Well, people aren't interested. Within 24 hours, there were 14 million views of this video. We went back to New York. The judge was going to rule on Friday. Well, Friday we did the show, and then Nermeen Sheikh and I, who co-host on Democracy Now!, went up to Toronto. I wasn't fleeing. It was the Toronto International Film Festival. There was a film on I.F. Stone, and they featured Democracy Now!, and so we were invited to speak after. But on Thursday, they issued an arrest warrant for me. For me, we were just filming. And again, I wasn't fleeing to Canada. I didn't know they'd issued the arrest warrant. So we spoke after the film, and the next day, University of Toronto had invited me to speak. And so I was speaking. All of a sudden, I always have my phone with me. I get on my phone, it says, you're under arrest. I thought, oh my God, one of the students has hacked my phone. Like, this is supposed to scare me or whatever. Okay, this is a joke. But I see it's a North Dakota number, so I'm not so sure. And I don't want to say it out loud. This is really serious. And so I just said, could someone call me a cab? I thought I'd race to the airport. And if I could get across back to the United States before the warrant goes into the system. And so I came back to the United States, and it was true. They'd issued an arrest warrant. And we thought, think of all the young reporters who want to cover this epic showdown. They're going to be afraid. If reporters are getting arrested, they're not going to go. And we have to show them this is what the corporate media has to do also. We will stand up for freedom of the press. Showing what is taking place. I knew that when we crossed, if they you know, if you encounter FBI or Border Patrol or police, you could be in trouble if there's a warrant. But if we didn't, so I said, we're going back to North Dakota. We're going to take on this, what? They are threatening to arrest me? So as we flew back into North Dakota, as we are landing, my North Dakota lawyer, not that I had one before, called and said, as we got on the tarmac, they've dropped the charges. You know, this is embarrassing for them. They brought more serious charges. They're charging you with a felony. I said, I don't understand. If I were to serve time, how long would it be? He said, like maybe a year. I said, a year? I came here for like 3 days. Oh my God, when do I have to turn myself in or when will I be arraigned? And he said, Monday. It was Friday. I said, okay, we have 2 days to cover the protests. We've got a lot to get done. And we, on that morning, we broadcast right across from the courthouse so I wouldn't be late. It's the courthouse and the jail and the Ten Commandments in between. That was what it looks like in Mandan, North Dakota. So who did we interview? We interviewed the chairman of the Standing Rock Sioux at the time, Dave Archambault. I asked him, did you ever get arrested? There was some self-interest here. I wanted to know what would happen to me. And he said, yes. He said right early on, because they were so involved with civil disobedience. He was the chairman. He was like the president. He was the 45th, I think, chairman of the Standing Rock Sioux. And I said, what happened? And he said, well, they stripped me. And they put me in an orange jumpsuit, and I was jailed. And then I interviewed Dr. Sarah Jumping Eagle. She's the pediatrician of the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. She cared about the health of children if this pipeline were to go through. She was one of the first to be arrested. I said, what happened to you? Same, stripped, put in an orange jumpsuit, and jailed. How much humiliation can a people take? And so this was now getting a lot of attention. We finished the broadcast. Hundreds of people now came. Many indigenous people came. They were standing there along the line of our broadcast truck, and I was going to have to cross the street. And then I got a call from the North Dakota Public Radio, longtime host, knows every player and every scene here, and he says, the judge isn't going to do it. He's not going to sign the warrant against you. There's too much attention here. This is too hot. I mean, the New York Times, the BBC, Al Jazeera, Vogue magazine was covering this, and I didn't think I merited that, but this is why it was interesting. When the media shines a spotlight in the right direction, it wasn't just me that got off that day. There were a number of indigenous Native American people who were going to court, and their charges were dropped too. When the media sheds the spotlight in the right direction, that's what all of our goal is, to keep those microphones open, because when they are exposed to the light of day, that's when justice happens. My two final stories are Mamie Till Mobley, this remarkable woman who, after her son Emmett Till, in 1955, she sent him to be with his aunt and uncle in Mississippi to get out of the Chicago heat and to get away from the city to be safe. He's with his cousins and his aunt and uncle, and he's dragged out of his bed in the middle of the night by a white mob, and he is tortured and shackled to a weight that ends up in the bottom of the Tallahatchie River. They said he wolf whistled at a white woman. When his body was dredged up and sent back to Chicago, Mamie, his mother, this remarkable, fierce fighter, said, I want the casket open, you know, his horribly distended, mutilated head. I want the casket open for the wake and the funeral. She wanted the world to see the ravages of racism, the brutality of bigotry, and thousands passed by his casket and saw. Mamie Till Mobley and Jet Magazine took pictures and published them, and they were seared into the history and consciousness of this country. Mamie Till Mobley had something very important to teach the press of today. Show the pictures. Show the images. broadcast the voices. Whether we're talking about the ravages of racism, the brutality of occupation, whether we're talking about U.S. troops deployed on the streets of the United States, immigrants taken in the middle of night, students having their visas revoked before they know it, learning of it as they're being arrested. When you see these images, you will say no. And I believe this of people across the political spectrum. It is critical that we expose what is happening. Stay away from the pundits. Go right to the people who are most affected and only telling their stories if they can't tell their own, if they've been taken, if their livelihoods are threatened. Which brings me at the end to the White Rose Collective, to a remarkable brother and sister named Hans and Sophie Scholl, back to World War II. Hans was a medical student at the University of Munich. Sophie was his little sister. She was a college student at the University of Munich. They weren't Jewish. They were German Christians. But they thought, what can we do in the face of the Nazi atrocity? And together with professors and other students, they decided that they would unleash a series of pamphlets so the Germans would never be able to say we didn't know. And they issued 6 pamphlets in full. And one of those pamphlets said at the top, "We will not be silent." They distributed these everywhere. In the cover of night, they would drop them in an alley at a marketplace, throw them over the atrium of the University of Munich, so all these pamphlets would flutter in the wind down to the ground. Hans and Sophie and their professor were caught. They were charged, they were tried, they were convicted, and they were beheaded. But that philosophy, that motto, should be the Hippocratic Oath of us journalists today, should be Hippocratic Oath of us all today. We will not be silent.
How do you suggest that we tell these stories when it feels like they have no qualms with killing us? You know, how do we show compassion? How do we still stay professional? How do we still give these stories out and tell the whole story and really appeal to these people who, quite frankly, don't see us as human?
Well, I so appreciate your question. It's so important. You have to stay safe, that is for sure. I think what's important is that it is more than you. That you have a team of people, and the more you broadcast the voices of the community, that whole community rallies around you. You are definitely not alone. That's the power of community media. I've always found how amazing it is. You never can predict how people actually feel, that they respond to others telling their own truths, and it just so transcends politics. And you just have to forge forward, making sure that you are being fair, you're being accurate, you're seeking out people telling their stories. If you're telling someone's story because somehow they can't tell it, that it is well sourced. And but I will not minimize that it is a very frightening time, right? You have President Trump, after the assassination attempt against him, he gave a rally where he said, you know, I have glass here, plexiglass, he said, that protects me, but I can see if you took a direct shot here, you could hit the press right there. Ask him, what are you talking about? And so I don't minimize the danger. I also think that I always think of what Isabel Allende, the great writer who wrote House of the Spirits, and I just interviewed for her latest book.
about another time in Chile. They have their September 11th, 1973, when the democratic leader, Salvador Allende, died in the palace as the Pinochet forces came to power. Unfortunately, the U.S. backed Pinochet forces. But it was a coup decades before, similarly, fascism flourishing there. Isabel has always said, there are more of us than there are of them. For every thug in a community, there are 100, there are 1,000, there are 10,000 compañeros and compañeras who are there deeply caring about the community. It's not a matter of Democrat or Republican, or it's a matter of being human. And I think we have to express that humanity on the air. But I don't minimize your fear, but you're here for a reason. And you have important stories to tell and to let the community tell.
What role do you believe radio journalism and independent media play, not only in reporting on fascism, but actively resisting it? Thinking back to the legacy of Radio Venceremos in El Salvador, and where is the line between reporting and resistance, and when do you believe it must be crossed? Thank you.
This is a time when institutions are shutting down. They are, the public space is shrinking. And this is the time when community radio can shine. Someone can just hear a voice on the radio and pull over to the side of the road. And that touches not only that person, but the person they tell and the person they tell. It is old-fashioned in a sense. But, you know, every media outlet is now global. It's both community, but online, it's global.org. And I think just doing that work is about resistance. I just came from New York. You know, there was a run of Good Night and Good Luck with George Clooney and Alana Glazer, and the amazing story, the telling the story of Edward Murrow and taking on the Red Scare. We are not alone in this country. All of us are speaking to people all over the world all the time. We probably have more in common with each other than we do perhaps with our governments. And really looking at places, I think of Maria Ressa, right? She won the Nobel Peace Prize for her journalism, taking on Duterte in the Philippines. And she came in a few years ago. She came in recently, too. But a few years ago, she told us about what was happening. She'd accused him of being a murderer. She had the evidence. She was really taking him on. Now he's sitting in jail. But that's beside the point, at The Hague. And his daughter is the vice president. Maria said, you know, when we walked out of the studio, she said, when I just told that story, it wasn't just a story about my country, the Philippines, and, you know, the authoritarian push of this president. This is a story for you to learn for your country, because this is what you may well see in the next few years. And, of course, she was prophetic. And that's also why it's important that we all be global. And this goes to your question, too. People are dealing with these issues all over the world, and to hear these voices, we learn from them. They're trying to erase history now. I remember when I was growing up, the librarians were very scared of the intertubes, you know, because I guess we call it the internet now, but very scared because they said, well, we always have to keep a paper copy. And I would say that's, you know, so old-fashioned. You know, digitally, it's much more also environmental. You're cutting down less trees. No, we always need a paper copy because you never know. They could change it. They could erase it. And that is what we are seeing. Did you know in the last few weeks on the White House website, they have now removed all the transcripts of President Trump? Anything he said, this is the president. I'm not talking about grassroots movements. They said the only way you can best understand him is you have to listen to the video, the audio. They understood that because of the number of lies that are put out, you then have them very easily. Not that you can't transcribe it, but they're not going to make it easy for you. And think about the universities, the grants people are running. So many grants have been shut down. Science is so challenged now in this country, the whole investigation of the truth in every field. But it's critical that we have the record, as Robert F. Kennedy now, as health secretary, is erasing the knowledge base on everything from vaccines to cancer research to Alzheimer's. He just ended the vaccine advisory board. And then all of those records get wiped away unless we actually have records of them. And I see radio as the oral history of this country, and how important is that be protected, but not only looking back, looking forward, and ever expanding that range of voices that we bring people.
You were just listening to Amy Goodman on the power of community media. She spoke in Salt Lake City in mid-June 2025. Amy Goodman is the award-winning host of Democracy Now!, the daily syndicated radio and TV program. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 40th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Claudia de la Cruz, Vijay Prashad, Peter Beinert, Angela Davis, Gabor Mate, and Arundhati Roy. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Amy Goodman on the Power of Community Media, and for Noam Chomsky's classic book, How the World Works, call us 1-800-444-1977. Or go online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. To get them, just call us 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with Thelonious Monk, straight, no chaser.
Now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC. If you missed your favorite program, don't worry. You can listen to podcasts of our program at cjsf.ca.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections.
When people buy used goods and vintage clothes from Goodwill, that money helps fund job training programs, including a new effort to prepare people for careers in clean energy. Goodwill's Clean Tech Accelerator launched in 5 states last year and is now expanding to more. It offers paid training in solar installation, electric vehicle charger maintenance, and more.
Most people that come to us are coming to us because they're looking for a new opportunity. They have either been stuck in one particular industry or job and they're wanting to gain a new skill, and then they're wanting to provide a better life for themselves and their family.
Monique McDaniels is with Goodwill in South Carolina. Her chapter is training people to install and service HVAC systems and electric heat pumps, which can heat and cool a home without oil or gas. Participants get hands-on experience with the technology.
We'll have an actual lab where they'll be working on the actual machines. They'll be able to touch it, feel it, break it apart.
She says market research shows there are already well-paid jobs in her area for people with these skills.
You can come in with very little knowledge or experience. You can gain these skills and really create the quality of life that you're looking for yourselves and for your family.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
I'm DJ Coco.
And I'm DJ Star.
Come join us for Slumber Party, Tuesdays at 6 p.m.
You'll hear female artists, oversharing, and research on health, psychology, and identity.
Hope to see you there.